This is Vermont Edition. Jane Lindholm is on maternity leave. I'm Nina Keck. Depending on the survey you look at, per capita Americans drink just over 20 gallons of milk a year. Add in cheese and other dairy products, and the number jumps to about 34 gallons of milk per person. But how the price of all that milk is determined might surprise you. Federal milk pricing guidelines date back to the Agriculture Adjustment Act passed during the Great Depression. If federal lawmakers can't agree on a new farm bill, federal law dictates that the old price guarantees set up back in the 1930s and 40s will go into effect, pushing milk prices way up. Pundits have been referring to the situation as the looming dairy cliff. Senator Patrick Leahy says U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has agreed not to phase in the decades-old law as long as the House and Senate are making progress on a new farm bill.
Nobody's going to push him to go immediately into that. Nobody wants him to. You suddenly have a doubling, tripling of cost of milk in the stores. That's not going to do anybody any good. So I think so long as the secretary knows that we're very close, both Republicans and Democrats coming close on the bill, he'll hold off doing anything, and he has the flexibility to do that.
That's Senator Leahy talking about the federal farm bill that is still a work in progress in Washington. Here to explain how that farm bill and federal milk pricing in general impact Vermont dairy farmers and consumers are Diane Bothfeld, Deputy Secretary of Vermont's Agency of Agriculture, and Bob Wellington, Senior Vice President for AgriMark, a northeastern dairy cooperative with more than 1,200 dairy farmers. AgriMark also operates four dairy plants, two in Vermont, one in Massachusetts, and one in New York. Bob Wellington and Diane Bothfeld, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nia.
So, Diane Bothfeld, let me start with you. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of how federal milk prices are set, can you talk about how most Vermont dairy farmers get paid and who they sell their milk to?
Well, in Vermont, there are several dairy marketing co-ops, and AgriMark that Bob works for is definitely one of them. There's the St. Albans Cooperative Creamery and also a creamery called Dairy Lee and Dairy Farmers of America. So there's multiple places for the dairy farmers to sell their milk. They end up being members of these cooperatives, and the cooperative is responsible for marketing the milk of their members. So there are a few farms in Vermont, actually a growing number, that are making their own dairy products and marketing them independently. We have several that do fluid bottled milk, but the majority are making cheese as well as yogurts and butters, et cetera. So, but the majority of milk in Vermont is sold through the dairy cooperatives.
And Bob Wellington, what percentage of milk produced in Vermont is sold for drinking, and what percentage of it is used to make those other products like cheese and yogurt and that?
Well, actually, there's not a whole lot of population in Vermont to drink up the local milk, so a lot of that milk either flows down to southern New England, and it goes down to the Boston, Hartford, Providence markets. So probably the majority of that milk does end up in the bottle for consumers to drink it, mostly, though, in southern New England. And then probably about half of it stays in the state. As was noted, we operate two cheese facilities. One's in Cabot, Vermont, and of course that's the Cabot brand that our dairy farmers own, and the other one's in Middlebury. Ben and Jerry's, of course, uses a lot of milk. There's some really good brands that use manufacturing milk, but most of the drinking milk ends up going down south into southern New England.
To the higher population centers.
Right, sure. Because that's where the higher prices are at. USDA pays higher prices in those areas to encourage farmer milk down to where the population is at.
Well, so let's delve into pricing. And Diane Bothfeld, let me start with you. I'm going to give you the first opportunity to explain in somewhat understandable terms how the price of milk is set.
Well, it is complex, as you mentioned in your preview of this show. But it is a national level pricing system that is federally regulated. It's based on macro level supply and demand. So nationally, what's the supply of milk versus what's the demand of milk? And then the sales of products across the nation. And those products are cheese, butter, dried milk powder, and dried whey powder. A survey of all those prices and the amount sold is taken across the nation. And then those values are put into a series of calculations that come out with prices for milk and how its end use. So the milk that goes into fluid has one price. The milk that goes into cheese has another. The milk that goes into butter has a third price, and then the cheese. So a little bit, are we confused yet? Yes. And then the farmers are paid a blend based on the use of those four types of end uses of milk. And so farmers are paid basically a month behind the month they produce the milk in. So milk that's produced today in January, farmers won't be paid for that until really the end of February.
And then are they paid at February prices, which might be different than when they were making the milk in January?
No, this is all about January, what happened in January. So basically, by the time all those calculations are completed, we spoke of, it's the end of February before there's a final price on the milk produced in January. So it's all about January's data. So it's, in a way, it's a month behind in your payment for the milk and the activities you did in January.
Bob Wellington, do you want to add anything to that explanation? I actually thought it was pretty clear.
Well, no, I think it was clear, but it can sound very convoluted because, you know, you'll say milk is milk, but milk has different values relative to how it's used. I mean, most people value milk the most if you can get it in that, you know, gallon, half gallon, quart to put on your cereal, give to your kids. It's always been a crucial product for people. But milk is now used in so many products today that it's also very valuable in yogurt. Greek yogurt's an expanding product out there. And then on the other hand, the milk is produced every day. So you have to find a home for it. If someone doesn't necessarily want it for, you know, their cereal that day, or there's too much that day, we got to find a home. So then there's another value for like butter and non-fat dry milk powder. Butter you can make, you can keep butter for several months in a freezer, for example. Non-fat dry milk powder is like that carnation type powder that people would have in the past, and that can be stored for a year or more. So there's different uses, different values. We try to capture the highest value for each use, and then we turn that back to dairy farmers. It's not always as successful as we would like, but it does help farmers, particularly in our area where we have a lot of high-value uses for milk.
You mentioned the perishability just now, that, you know, the milk that we drink has a much shorter shelf life than, say, milk that's used for other purposes. But talk a little bit, if you would, Bob Wellington, about the different categories. You know, how much of a differential is in price point does higher quality milk get that the kind that ends up on our cereal every morning?
Well, that's crucial, and farmers have done a tremendous job on increasing the quality of their milk, and they can also, that milk goes for about it could go as much as 30 or 40 cents a gallon that for that milk, but farmers are paid on average about the same price. In our co-op, for example, because we make Cabot cheese and products like that, quality milk is absolutely important. So we pay our farmers more for the quality premiums, more than what USDA has set. But generally, all milk has to be grade A, has to be great quality. We're lucky. In Vermont and the surrounding areas, farmers are particularly known for their quality products and the quality milk. And that's really good because we've had to have that for fresh drinking milk. You're going to know right away if there's a problem on fresh drinking milk. You're going to know right away if you're making a high-quality cheese or other product. Yogurt is a good example. So we've been very fortunate. Our farmers do get paid more for higher quality milk, but generally all farmers make a really good quality here in Vermont.
All right. Listeners, have you always wondered how milk is priced? Or maybe you've been one of those few who can explain it to friends at dinner parties, those lucky few. We'd like to hear your thoughts. What do you think of the current system, and how might it be improved? 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call to jump into our conversation. Again, 1-800-639-2211. We're talking about milk pricing today on Vermont Edition. You can also post your comment on our website, vpr.net/Vermont Edition. So I want to touch on the history of milk pricing, because I found it very interesting when I started reading up on this that milk pricing initiatives first began developing after the Civil War. Then during the Great Depression, the Agriculture Adjustment Act was passed. And then other changes were set into law in the late 1940s, laws that still haunt us to this day. Diane Bothfield, can you talk a little bit about the history, kind of take us through how the current milk pricing system evolved?
Yeah, I can do that. I think what's important is in the very old days, even in the early 1920, there really wasn't any system of payment for farmers, and many of the farms were up on the hills away from the villages or away from some of our major towns. Farmers would bring their milk down to the village to try to sell, and maybe they got the good price, maybe they didn't. Maybe the buyer would say, okay, I don't need any more today, but gee, I'll take your milk for, 50% less than the first person who got here. So there really was this melee of pricing and nothing a farmer could depend on. So the issues with the Great Depression and farmers going out of business and the concern from the government of would there be enough milk? Would there be milk available? How can we put in place a floor to prices or a known price that farmers can produce to? So that's really why, all these laws started to come into being. There are tweaks and changes over the years of, we've got too much milk, or maybe we should have something that's related to cost of production. And so there's been a lot of tweaks over the years. And in the last tweak was in the 1980s, there was something called parity pricing that really gave farmers a great deal, but the federal government was doing purchasing of dairy products, that cheese, butter, non-fat, dry milk, to keep that parity price up there. So the government was making the majority of the purchases, taking the milk and the dairy products off the market, which kept the price high. But then we hear about these stories of, great caves full of butter and cheese just sitting there. You can store it for years.
Was that when we also heard about the milk dumping that was going on?
Milk dumping. Sometimes that's been around, milk strikes and we need a better price, so we'll throw away our milk. A lot of milk, as Bob stated, made into cheese and non-fat dry milk or butter can be stored for longer periods. And the federal government was buying and doing that storage. That really changed in the late 1980s and it's been more quote-unquote market-driven just because of the fact that the federal government is involved, so it's not a totally free market, but it really is less and less buying by the federal government of those products, and so it's a lot more free market. Currently, there's a lot of change coming with the amount of milk and dairy products that are exported from our United States. It's almost 15-16% of the milk produced in our nation now is being made into dairy products and exported. So there's been all those changes over the years of really concentrating on domestic consumption now versus, yes, we're covering our domestic consumption, but so much export is occurring as well.
Let me ask you, Bob Wellington, as someone who, is in the industry selling milk and all the different milk products, are the federal guidelines that are in play right now, are they up to date enough? Are the milk pricing guidelines and still relevant since they kind of many of them are throwbacks, as we just heard, to the 80s and prior?
Well, I think they are. There's a lot of reasons they went into effect, and a lot of it has to do with the type of product milk is. You mentioned perishability. That's still out there for milk, and it's got to be marketed from the farm within 1 or 2 days. You can't keep the milk there. You got to find a home for it. The demand for milk swings all over. Schools go out of session. They don't need as much drinking milk in place, particularly in the summertime. People don't drink as much milk. So we got to have a balance to that when that happens. So that's where a lot of these regulations are set up. I mean, we've had improvements that we've been able to do over time. One was something called the Northeast Dairy Compact that set a floor on the drinking milk prices, and it helped because it took out the volatility. So consumers didn't see high and low, and it got an average price that worked out well for everybody. Unfortunately, other areas of the country didn't like that. They thought we in Vermont and New England had an advantage, and so we lost that. So there are ways to improve it that we've been working at, but milk is milk, and cows still produce their milk, seasonally to some extent. They tend to produce more in the spring than they do in the hot summer. And so we have to have a pricing system that accommodates that.
All right. Listeners, we want to take some of your calls and comments. Josh wrote in, as someone who grew veggies without any subsidies or pricing system, I have to say that maybe a market system means we drink less milk, and maybe that's okay. We might lose dairies, but change is not always bad. 1-800-639-2211, the number to call if you want to jump into our conversation. Let's go take a couple of phone calls now. Let's go to Montreal and check in with Michael. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you so much. What a great topic. It's a pity that here in Quebec, just across the international border, we're not discussing the issue of pricing. I was surprised, first of all, that in the U.S., the federal government regulates the price of milk and production. We pay the highest price, we have the metric system per liter, about it ranges between $2 and $2.50 Canadian for a liter of milk. And if I go to Ontario or Vermont, or sometimes I'm overseas, I'm shocked to see how much we pay for milk. It seems to me that it's a basic foodstuff, and there should be a price ceiling for it. But here, it keeps going up and up. And in supermarkets for consumers, it's becoming a luxury item to drink milk.
Huh. Interesting. Let me. You're not a farmer, are you, Michael?
No, but I live in the countryside, and when I come into the city, I try to buy the local dairies. The problem is we have this cartel, if you will, which is the Quebec Dairy Producers Association, and they seem to be fixing the price. And when you buy a sort of milk product from a small dairy, it's there on the shelves, and then suddenly it disappears. So it seems that this cartel doesn't allow for small dairy producers to have their, you know, living space get
sure.
their product out on the market, which also sort of creates a monopoly. And there's a lot of price gouging of the consumer as a result.
Well, I appreciate you calling in, Michael, and sharing that. I want to get to some other calls. Again, if you'd like to join our conversation talking about milk pricing today on Vermont Edition, 1-800-639-2211, our phone number. Let's go to Wilmington now and talk with Rob. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi. Hey, my question has to do with how cost of production is factored into the price people pay for their dairy products, and how that relates in different parts of the country, given that probably in other parts of the country, cost of production is different than it is in Vermont.
Who would like to take a stab at that? Go ahead, Diane.
Okay. I'd be glad to. Hello, Rob from Wilmington. The cost of production, you know, in a calculation formula really isn't involved in the pricing of milk. They say it's involved at a macro level, as in, you know, milk prices go up, milk prices go down. If they go down low enough, it doesn't meet farmers' cost of production and the supply of milk shrinks. So that is kind of the hard, you know, hard truth of some of this calculation, that technically cost of production is not involved at the federal level. We do know that cost of production of milk is different across the nation. Vermont and the Northeast states, having the tough winters that we have in the upper Midwest, that the cold weather can definitely, we need barns and buildings to keep the cows in. We need to store winter feed. We may not be able to grow the grains for the energy for the cows, et cetera. But there are regional differences in the pricing of milk called differentials, and the Northeast has a little bit higher cost, a little bit higher price based on the differentials in other parts of the country. But that's one way that the pricing of milk does give a little bit of a different price for different regions of the country.
If I could add that one of our concerns is that exact issue. And that is because if you look at some of the costs down in the western states where farmers are milking thousands or 5 or 10,000 cows, they could often have a lower cost level. And then USDA uses that increase in milk production in the marketplace to drive the price down at times. And when that happens, though, those farmers aren't going to supply a drop of fresh drinking milk or even very many dairy products to consumers here in the Northeast, but it's used as a mechanism to drive the price level down. And so that's really unfortunate. That's a real problem. I mean, I mentioned the dairy compact was one thing we tried to fix that with. We have a national pricing system, and it doesn't work well for all farmers, particularly farmers with higher costs and high population areas like we have.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about milk pricing today on Vermont Edition. Here to help explain how it all works are my guests Bob Wellington, Senior Vice President for AgriMark, a Northeastern Dairy Cooperative, and Diane Bothfeldt, Deputy Secretary of Vermont's Agency of Agriculture. We'll get to more of your calls and comments, as well as talk about how organic milk is priced after a short break. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, and today we're unraveling one of the more complicated formulas in American economics, milk prices. Go figure, huh? Listeners, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Maybe you operate a dairy farm, or perhaps you're a cheesemaker. What do you think of the way dairy prices are set? Do you have thoughts on how to improve things? You can post your comments or questions at vpr.net/Vermont Edition, or pick up the phone and give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. My guests today are Diane Bothfeldt, Deputy Secretary of Vermont's Agency of Agriculture, and Bob Wellington, Senior Vice President for AgriMark, Northeastern Dairy Cooperative. And we've been talking about conventional dairy farms and how their milk prices are set, but I'd also like to talk about how organic milk is priced, because this is handled quite differently. Joining us by phone to explain how organic milk pricing works is John Cleary, New England Manager for Organic Valley Co-op. John Cleary, thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Sure, glad to be here.
So give us the short version. How are prices for organic milk set?
Yeah, so Organic Valley, like AgriMark, is a farmer-owned cooperative, and the whole organic movement for dairy farmers began about 25 years ago, farmers that were interested not only in farming without chemicals, but also farmers that wanted to have a stronger voice in how pay prices were set. So the federal regulations set some minimum prices for all dairy farmers, but any dairy company can choose to pay more if they want to and if they have a business model that allows it. So the organic market is committed to having fair and stable pricing for farmers, so that's kind of our background philosophy. And the goal is to have that price set based on the farmer's, relatively set on based on the farmer's cost of production rather than just supply and demand. Now, the ability to achieve that depends on your business model, and you get into some nitty-gritty of, you know, how do you avoid an oversupply when you're dealing with a perishable product in order to maintain that stable pricing.
Well, and it sounds like organic farmers really value the stability of the price over maybe a higher initial price. Isn't that at least that's what I read?
Yeah, well, stability provide some long-term ability for farmers to plan their business. You know, when you have extreme volatility, what tends to happen is the smaller farms have less ability to weather the low prices. You tend to get, you know, only the lowest cost, most efficient producers surviving, which may give us the lowest cost product in the end, but it may not be best for our overall community. So organic is really about, you know, creating this relationship with the consumer that wants to support small family farms, you know, who are doing a good job. You know, if you can provide some financial stability to a farmer, that's a great way to help those farmers be good stewards of the environment.
And just so we throw some price differentials out there, compare the price of a gallon of organic milk to a regular milk off the shelf.
Yeah, organic milk on average is almost twice the cost of conventional milk on the shelf. And the price the farmer gets paid for that, depending on what the conventional prices are, at times the farmer price is about twice what the conventional farmer might be getting. But when conventional prices come up, the prices are a little closer. So, for example, right now, conventional mailbox prices may be somewhere around $21 to $22 a hundredweight. Organic prices right now are somewhere around $33 per hundredweight.
And I understand, too, that, you know, when you try to limit supply so that it matches demand, how do you do that? How do you figure out the growing demand for organic milk? Maybe sometimes it ebbs every year, and how do you adjust supply?
Yes, supply management is the core sort of business strategy that we have to use to maintain the stable price. So we're trying to predict what the market demand is going to be, you know, looking out to the future, and trying to predict how much milk our current members are making. Now, what we've decided to do to guarantee that stable price, we've had to put a system in place that could allow us to limit the amount of milk that farmers send to us if there simply isn't a market for it. So conventionally, a farmer can ship as much milk as you want, or you could start as many new farms as you want, regardless of if there's a decent home for that milk, and that oversupply may drive prices down. Whereas on the organic system, we only bring new farms on to match the growing demand. And if there is a time, say within our cooperative, when demand is flat or actually contracts, we have a system in place where we go back to our farmers and say, rather than lower the price, how about we try to all produce a little bit less milk to keep that in line with the demand and maintain our stable pricing. And the farmers have come to see that as being a relatively good deal. You know, in Canada, they control the milk supply through government regulations. In conventional markets here in the U.S., there's really no control over supply. And then organic is kind of an interesting private industry voluntary system of managing the milk supply cooperatively to achieve sort of a benefit for everyone. And that has really helped keep a lot of our smaller organic farms in business.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to check in with us today.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. John Cleary is the New England manager for Organic Valley Co-op. Let's go back to the phones, take a couple calls. Let's go to Bob, who's calling. I'm sorry. Let's go to Keith, who's calling from Moortown. Go ahead, Keith.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I heard your person say that the 100-pound weight was up around $21 now, which is great, but I understood that it sort of flatlined for about 20 years. It was around $12 or $14. And all the local farmers here, like, for instance, the Von Trapp family, just by default had to go into a sort of a premium product mode and making cheese because the it just wasn't worth it to try to, you know, go out and milk the small herd every day, you know, 24/7 or whatever for the price that they were getting. But that was the deal at the time. I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks. Diane Bothfelter, or who'd like to comment on that? Bob Wellington?
Well, I mean, I think what we've had over the last 20 years is a lot of volatility. Prices have gone down as low as the viewer was saying, but then it occasionally it bounces up to that $21, $22, some of the levels that are here. The volatility has been so destructive to dairy farmers, so it has been that variance over time on it. But for many farmers, an answer has been to go and try to get some value added. We do that as a co-op. You know, we talk about the Cabot brand where all our profits are returned back to farmers. But a lot of some farmers have gone become artisan cheesemakers, where they make their own cheese or they bottle their own milk in search of finding ways to stabilize their price. I mean, John mentioned what organic does, and I got to give them all the kudos in the world because they've done a model that has worked well for their farmers. Unfortunately, in conventional milk, any farmer across the country can come online, and if they want to tomorrow, they can be milking 10,000 cows.
Nat from Shelburne emailed us, why couldn't we have a system where dairy farmers and co-ops simply contract with each other to provide and then pay a contracted price for a certain amount of milk per month? The contracts could be a two-year renewable agreement, for example, that would give both farmer and co-op a degree of security. This would be supply and income management for both entities without the issues of involving the government in the dairy business. Rebecca from Enfield, New Hampshire, says that the best way to improve the system is get the government out of it. One thing I'd like to delve into a little bit more is how the current milk pricing system is, I guess, looking at this cliff, the milk cliff that we're talking about or that's being kind of bantied about. Diane Bothfelter, can you explain why this term milk cliff is coming up and how worried we should be about it?
Well, I think Senator Leahy at the beginning of the program stated it very well, that we have no farm bill at this point. There was no extension, et cetera. So the folks in Washington, D.C. are still working on getting a farm bill passed. So in that case, we've gone back to permanent law, which is back into the 1930s and 40s, et cetera. And with that in place, it's back to the old parity pricing where the government to purchase products would bring the price up to parity. So there is some concern that if where we are right now, the milk price could go up to $38 per 100 pounds if, and this is the big if, the federal government is purchasing cheese and butter and nonfat dry milk powder at a level that would support that $38 per 100 pounds of milk. So USDA Secretary Vilsack has made the statement that he's not implementing that government purchasing yet, but there's a lot of other steps that have to be put in place before we can start that purchasing. The cheese, the butter, the nonfat dry milk powder that the government would purchase has to be a very specific moisture level in the cheese, very specific packaging, differences that the processors of these products would have to choose to put in place to sell their products to the government. So there's a lot of steps that would have to take place before we got to that dairy cliff that we're talking about, that prices could go up so quickly. So the USDA Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack talking to or making it clear with Congress that if you can get the farm bill done, you know, really in the month of January or fairly soon in the first part of this year, then I won't start that purchasing to make these milk prices rise up to that cliff that people are talking about. But there's there's a lot of complexities to it. But I think, we really like the support that our Vermont congressional delegation has for the farm bill. I know Senator Leahy's on the Committee of Conference and working really hard. So we're hopeful that we will get the farm bill done and will not have to approach that dairy cliff any closer than we have.
All right. Well, let's take another phone call. Let's go to Morrisville now and check in with Dean. Hi, Dean. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the big thing with the milk price and like that is a lot of your consumers are not knowledgeable to your fat levels and everything else in the milk. And it's the only product that cannot be sold at its true market value. You have whole milk, 2%, 1%, and skim. If you could market it at its true market value, where your whole milk is 96.75% fat-free, people would buy it, and you couldn't keep it on the shelves.
Bob Wellington, what do you make of what Dean's talking about as far as sort of different categories? And how might that be different than what you were explaining in the beginning of the show, where you've got a higher quality of milk and maybe a lesser quality of milk used for some products?
Sure. I think Dean was saying was that, you know, regular producer milk, you know, runs 3.5 to 4% butterfat. It's a rich, good tasting milk. Gosh, you could get a Jersey cow and get 5% milk. And it's, you know, it's like drinking a really thick, high solids milk. And I think a lot of people would like that. I wouldn't say unfortunate, but the dietary habits have changed, and so many people have cut their amount of fat in the milk that they have gone more toward their 2% butterfat milk and 1%. In fact, 1% fat milk is the highest sales category we have now. And so it's really trying to give the consumers what they want at all levels. Fortunately, like I said, the quality has improved. So even at that lower fat test, the milk is probably as good or better tasting than it's been over time. Our goal is to give the consumers what they want. And even though I'd love it for consumers to all be drinking whole milk and consuming that butterfat, that's not what the consumer of today wants. So we have to make sure we provide it for them.
Sure. And Dean, thanks for that call. Diane Bothfeld, we just have a little bit of time left, and I want to just ask you, you know, if I could grant you the power to create a new milk pricing system or tweak this one, make some significant change, how would you change it, and how might you make it better?
Well, I think the aspect of the cost of producing the milk and by region, some way to include that into the pricing system. I know that, well, what is that price? Some farms have a high and some farms have a lower price. So how would you come up with that? But really incorporating that because it is so different regionally.
All right. Well, we'll have to end it there and just wait, I guess, and see what kind of a farm bill lawmakers in Washington are able to pass. I want to thank both of my guests for their help today explaining a rather complex topic. Diane Bothfeld is Deputy Secretary of Vermont's Agency of Agriculture, and Bob Wellington is Senior Vice President for AgriMark. Thanks to both of you very much.
Thank you, Nina.
Thank you, Nina.
Still to come, we'll hear how a new component of the state's Equal Pay Act that just went into effect will allow for more flexible work arrangements. And we'll read from some of the comments listeners sent to our virtual mailbag. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kekin for Jane Lindholm. During the 2013 legislative session, lawmakers passed Act 31, which included provisions that strengthened the state's 11-year-old Equal Pay Act. While most provisions of Act 31 went into effect last summer, the flexible working arrangements provision didn't become binding until last Wednesday, January 1st. VPR's Rick Singeri recently spoke with Carrie Brown, the executive director of the Vermont Commission on Women, to learn more about this new provision.
Carrie, explain what this provision of Act 31, the provision for flexible working arrangements, does for employees.
Well, this gives employees the right to request flexible working arrangements up to twice a year, and their employer needs to consider it and respond. And this, they are also protected against retaliation. And so they have the right to request it. They don't have to get it granted, but it does give them the right to ask.
Now, this was just a part of a bill passed last spring. Overall, what was the intent of Act 31, and how does this provision work to achieve that?
Well, Act 31 was a collection of techniques that were designed to try to address the wage gap between men and women. And this came out of a conference that the Attorney General's Office of Vermont held with the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Office that was looking at the wage gap between men and women. So as you may know, nationally, women earn about 77 cents for every dollar that men do. And in Vermont, it's more like 84 to 87 cents. So we're doing better than the national average. But there is still a gap. Men are making more money than women are. And there are lots of different reasons for that, including discrimination, including occupational segregation. Men and women are going into different kinds of jobs that pay more or pay less, and including time spent in the workforce and time taken off from the workforce. So this particular provision is trying to address the reality that there is kind of an expectation that women are going to be more responsible for family responsibilities than men are. And so they tend to be more likely to work part-time, to take time off from working, or to leave the workforce entirely. And that puts them at a disadvantage over the long run in making money compared to men. So this is a way to recognize the fact that when women have an opportunity for flexible working arrangements, they're more likely to work full-time, and they're more likely to stay in the workforce. And mm-hmm. So it gives them some support in doing that. It also recognizes the reality that it's no longer true that men aren't taking family responsibilities as much. There are lots and lots of men who are eager to assume more of those responsibilities, but are also not finding a workplace that's as supportive of that as they might like. So this is really a way to give both men and women the opportunity to balance their work and family responsibilities a little bit more equitably.
The rest of the law went into place last summer. Why not the flexible working arrangements provision, which was put off until the beginning of 2014?
Well, this is a brand new kind of thing, and we are the first place in the United States to do this, to have a law like this. There are similar laws in the UK and Australia, but this, we were the first one. Vermont was the first place in the U.S. to do this. And so because it was so new, we thought it would be a good idea to put it off a little bit and give folks a chance to learn a little bit more about it. Now, it's not necessarily going to cause a dramatically different way of life for people. The vast majority of employers are already doing this with their employees, and it's really not going to be onerous for them or cause any significant change to how they operate. But for those for whom it is going to be a change, it seemed like a good idea to build in a little extra time for some education about it.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us some examples of how employees will be able to utilize the new flexible working arrangement law?
Well, this is not designed for taking sick time or vacation time or something like that. It's really designed for intermediate or long-term changes in someone's regular working schedule. So, for example, if you have a child care situation where the child care center closes at 5 every day, you might make a request to your employer that you be able to come in earlier and leave a little bit earlier so that you can get to your child's child care center in time.
Mm-hmm.
That's an example of the kind of thing that might fall under flexible working arrangements.
What is the employer's responsibility with this new law?
The employer needs to discuss the request with the employee, and they need to consider it in good faith, and then they need to respond. And if the request was made in writing and the employer is denying the request, they have to do that in writing also. But if they're granting it, they can just do it verbally. And if it wasn't made in writing, then they could just do it all verbally.
What are reasons that an employer is able to cite to deny an employee's request for a flexible arrangement?
An employer has no obligation whatsoever to grant the request. So an employer can deny the request for any reason that makes sense to that employer. And they need to consider it in good faith, and they need to discuss it. So they can't just dismiss it out of hand without even thinking about it, but they are under no obligation to grant it. So they can say no.
So does the law really have enough teeth to protect employees?
Well, I think it does because it includes a protection against retaliation, and so that an employee can make these requests and know that even if the requests are turned down, they won't suffer any kind of impact from their employer for asking. And then if someone feels that they have been treated unfairly or that their employer hasn't complied, perhaps they haven't discussed it with them or they haven't even considered it or they haven't responded, then the Attorney General's office or the Human Rights Commission can provide enforcement.
Why was this flexible work provision even necessary?
It's a way for the state to really affirmatively say that it's important for people to be able to balance work and family responsibilities and to provide support for those employers that are doing this already, which, as I say, is the majority of them.
Were there any prior laws or regulations in place in Vermont regarding flexible workplace arrangements prior to Act 31?
Well, there are a lot of collective bargaining agreements that include provisions where employees can request changes to their work schedule. But in terms of legal protections of this kind, no, this is the first.
Looking ahead, if you could say a year from now or 5 years from now, how do you think the flexible working arrangement provision of Act 31 will affect working men and women in Vermont?
Well, I hope that there will be some employees who right now are feeling like they might get fired if they even ask. I hope that there will be some of those who will know that they can ask. And I hope that there will be more employers who recognize that it works well for them. It's in their interest to be able to work with employees to find schedules that work for everybody.
Who was involved in crafting this legislation?
There was a huge group of people. It was really spearheaded by the Vermont Attorney General's office, and it included, there were like 70 or 80 people who were part of the discussions in some way or other. And it included folks from academia, folks from state government, lots of lawyers, folks from the nonprofit advocacy community, legislators. It was quite a broad swath.
Overall, are you happy with how the legislation came out?
I'm very happy with it, yes. I think it has the potential to make a significant difference in the long run.
Carrie Brown is the Executive Director of the Vermont Commission on Women. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find a link with more information on the flexible working arrangements provision of Act 31 at our website, vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And now some of the comments our listeners have sent in. Producer Sage Van Wing joins me now to read from our virtual mailbag. Hi, Sage.
Hi, Nina. So last week we challenged you to sum up your year for us in a very special way, the short form poetry of haiku.
And you rose to the challenge. We received hundreds of haikus, far too many to read on the show. We also got this note from Susan Zenith Collins, a teacher at Montgomery Elementary School. She writes, "We used your show as a classroom activity. The students had been working on poetry, writing, and interpretation, and this seemed like the perfect addition. The kids absolutely loved the freedom of working with haikus. At first, they were intimidated by the short nature, but soon realized that a lot could be said in a few words, and that fewer words actually made them more powerful. Thank you for making this this available."
We're more than happy to help, Susan. And we thought we'd read some of your students' haikus. Bethany wrote, "Crazy weather came, an ice storm had fallen, and darkness had sprung."
Henry wrote, "The year of the snake, the earth was choked with weather, of ice storms and rain."
Megan sounds like she might have had a rough year. She wrote, "The scary blue lights. At least it's all over now. We'll never forget."
And Philip wrote, "Year full of wonder, creation, innovation, imagination."
Thanks for all of your haikus. And of course, you don't have to limit your communications to us with poetry. Feel free to contact us anytime about whatever you hear on the show.
You can also like us on Facebook or email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. And if you're using our show in the classroom, let us know that too. Thanks, Sage.
You're welcome, Nina.
And that's it for today. We are still getting some posts from our milk pricing story. Ray wrote in to say, I think there has to be a better way to do it than we presently do. Canadians seem to use a quota system so as to avoid overproduction, and it is my understanding that they've been able rather generally to preserve smaller farms, such as those that we cherish, without the farmers having to almost literally work themselves to death in order to get by. You can keep this conversation going at VPR.net. Tomorrow, Bob Kinzel will sit down with Senate leaders from the Republican, Democratic, and Progressive parties to discuss the priorities for the new legislative session. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. From PEG TV Studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.